Alright, so we read John 6 last week, looking at the feeding of the 5,000. Alright, this side you're on Matthew 14. And then this side of the room you're on Luke 9. Alright, I prepped you, you're going to read for us this morning. Alright, read our Matthew passage. Matthew 14, verses 13 through 21. Nice and loud for us.
21.
Now, when Jesus heard that he withdrew from wandering about this lonely place by himself, but when the crowd heard it, they followed him from the top town. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. Now when it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, "This is disrobing place, and the day is now over. Send the crowd away to go into the villages and buy food for themselves." But Jesus said, "They need not go away. You give them something to eat." They said to him, "We have only 5 loaves here and 2 fish." And he said, "Bring them here to me." And he ordered the crowd to sit down on the grass, and taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up and looked up to heaven and said, "Say what?" Then he brought the loaves to Moses and gave them to the disciples. And the disciples gave them to the crowd. And they are ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of the brown pieces left over. And those who ate were about 5,000 men besides women and children.
All right, so what are the details of Matthew's edition? If you guys want to join us in Matthew for a few minutes, you're welcome to. So what are the details? Walk through the story for me.
He withdrew from the boat.
Okay, he gets out of a boat. Was there a boat in John 6? Okay, we need to flip back over to John 6. Does Jesus get out of a boat? That's not the passage before, James. Well, he had crossed the other side of the Sea of Galilee, so it's presumed that he had gotten out of a boat.
It's implied.
Yep. All right, so he gets out of a boat. What else? What's the next thing that happens?
He heals men the sick.
All right. What?
He saw a great crowd, he healed their sick.
And he saw a great crowd, he healed their sick. Yeah. Are you getting that from Matthew?
Yeah.
Alright. We got the healing of the sick. What else? He heals sick.
The same question about, or Jesus asking you where to buy food.
Alright, let's not get that far yet, Tyler.
Now in the evening. Now it was.
Hold on. We started in verse 14. Maybe we should have looked at verse 13. Jaleel, you got Matthew 14, 13. Can you read that verse for us?
When Jesus heard of it, he departed thence by ship into the desert place apart. And when the people had heard, therefore, they followed him on foot out of the cities.
All right. So he goes to a desolate place. Where is he in John chapter 6? Go back to John chapter 6. We're going to be flipping back and forth all morning. So go ahead and keep some fingers in pages as you turn away.
What was the question?
Matthew says he goes to a desolate place. What did John say? Where did he go?
He's on a mountain.
He's on a mountain. Okay, well, is a mountain a desolate place?
It can't be.
It could be.
If it's the same geographical.
Right, but I mean, just think about that for just a second, that one guy records it as desolate, one records it as a mountain. All right, now we're looking at two. Okay, let's, while we're doing this, let's go ahead and go look at Luke. What does Luke say about this? Luke 9. Where does he go in Luke? How does Luke record his location? It's Luke chapter 9, verse 10. Wait, Tyler, you found it. Read it and tell us the answer again.
On their return, the apostles told him all they had done. And he took them and withdrew apart to a town called Bethsaida.
Well, now we've got, from Luke, it's neither desolate place in Matthew. In John, it's a mountain. Barry, we might need to add mountain to the John column.
I got the New King James Version says, he took them and went aside privately to a deserted place, brought into the city of called Bethsaida.
Oh, okay.
So
what we've done now is we've taken, he's gone just outside the city of Bethsaida to this desolate area. But the closest city would be Bethsaida. Okay.
So wouldn't that desolate area be a mountain?
Great question. All right, we got one more gospel we need to look at. Let's go to Mark. Let's go to Mark 6. Where are we in this conversation with Mark chapter 6? Where does it say that he goes then? Verse 30.
Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest for a while.
All right, so in Mark, it's desolate place, and we're looking for what? What's the objective?
Rest.
What does... So now think about that dynamic now. Jeremy, remember what you said Jesus does? What did you say he does? All right, does that sound like they're resting?
Eight.
Nope.
What's the New King James Version say?
Did you go to Mark 6? You can pick up at verse 30.
Yeah.
Come aside by yourself to a deserted place and rest a while.
All right. And then if you jump down to verse 32.
So they departed to a deserted place in the boat by themselves.
All right. Let's see, if we keep reading on in Mark, do we get any other details? Go ahead, Nathaniel.
When the multitude saw them departed, and many knew him, and ran there on foot from all the cities. They arrived before them and came together to him. Jesus, when he came out, saw a great multitude, and was moved with compassion for them, because they were like sheep that had no shepherd. So he began to teach them many things. When the day was now far spent, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place, and already the hour is late."
All right, that should be good. All right, so we got desolate or deserted place in Mark. Okay, well, which one's right?
Desolate and deserted.
Where are we? I mean,
which one is right?
Well,
yeah, which one's right?
So Luke said Bethsaida outside of the city of Bethsaida. So would that be?
Luke doesn't say outside the city of Bethsaida, does he? Was that his?
Isn't that what the? Yeah.
Okay, so. Desolate place outside Bethsaida.
And then what was it? John said a mountain?
Yeah, John says a mountain.
So in that geographical location for Bethsaida, is there a mountain nearby?
There is mountainous areas there.
So then would that...
Because if you'll remember, basically think Jordan River, mm-hmm. and everything from Jordan River, as you're looking at a map from the Jordan River to the right, mountains. Think mountains before you get to desert. So mountains, then desert. Is pretty much how the geography lays out. So, yes. So even though all four of them have something different, is any of them wrong?
No.
No, they're just describing a different perspective of what they saw. One of them focused on the city that was nearby. One of them focused on the hills that were nearby. One of them focused on the fact that there's nothing around us. The idea is it's remote. All right, now, what's the next detail we should focus on? The variance between these narratives.
Well, Matthew said the time of day.
Okay, Matthew says the time of day. Let's start digging into that. So someone find Matthew, and in Matthew, tell us what's the time of day from Matthew's perspective.
Evening.
Okay, evening. So it's evening time for Matthew. What about Mark?
It says the hour is late.
Okay, it's a late hour. All right, and what about Luke? Luke 9. What does Luke say as far as the time of day?
It just says the day began to wear away.
Okay, so the day's just going away, just late in the day. What about John? Did John give us any timestamps? So John doesn't give us any time.
Well, it does say that like a month or the time of the year, it says the Passover was at hand.
Okay, we've got Passover. Did anyone else tell us about the Passover?
No.
We've read the first couple verses of really each gospel account. Why do you think no one else tells us about the Passover? Okay, one at a time. Jeremy?
What they celebrating it early?
Okay, they celebrated the Passover early, but why does no other gospel account reference the time of the Passover? I mean, we can plot within a week or two of when the Passover is. So as soon as they put that, you know, it'd be like saying, hey, you know, it was right around Christmas, and immediately everyone goes to, oh, it's December. Like, your mind just went there. You can't stop it from going there because it's a fixed date in our calendar. That's what he's done. So, did anyone else reference Passover? Matthew, Luke, or Mark? Did anyone?
No.
Okay. So, what should that tell us then? Well, what does that tell us? Does it tell us anything?
One out of the three, or one out of the four, only says Passover.
Yeah. What does it tell us that only one of four says it tells us it's Passover?
The time of year.
Okay, the time of the year. So does time of the year have bearing on...
Oh. Isn't this like how many Passovers were in Jesus' ministry, right?
Jesus' ministry is going to have three Passovers.
So then this is signifying one of four, right?
Okay. So maybe Blake's suggesting that maybe this Passover reference... is kind of keeping the timestamps on Jesus' ministry as a whole. Could very well be. You can certainly use it as that. But what we don't know, and this is why we're going to keep asking the question, is why did John do that? Why did John give us the reference of Passover? Maybe it's to keep track of time. Are there other reasons he could have done it? If so, what are they? What's going on at Passover?
A lot of people coming to Jerusalem.
Right, but he left Jerusalem at this point. We know he's in the desolate, remote, deserted, Bethsaida, mountainous region. He's gone out of Jerusalem. But John still gave us that timestamp of Passover. Why do you think John does that? Why do you drop details when you're telling a story?
For better understanding.
Better understanding?
To hide something.
Wait, what, Malachi?
To hide something.
No, when I say drop, I mean like put it in there, not like leave it out.
Oh.
Why do you add details when you're telling a story?
So it makes sense.
So it makes sense?
So. Kind of commentary in the Bible by David Cruiser says the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. And it says John is only one of the four gospel writers.
Read this louder, Blake. I don't know that Jeremy can hear you.
So the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. John is the only one of the four gospel writers who told us this took place near the time of the Passover. Perhaps this great multitude was made up of Galilean pilgrims on their way to Jerusalem for Passover.
All right. Perhaps this large multitude is people headed to. But all he did was tell us, like, who they could have been, not why.
Right.
All right. When you tell a story, why do you include background details?
Setting.
For the setting. Okay. So what's the setting of John? John clearly wants you to think Passover. So maybe you should redirect to John. Go to John now. Do a little bit of a survey of John 6 and look and see, is there anything that may be going on in John's ministry or John's perspective of the ministry that you need, would need to have this Passover reference? No, like, go back to our passage in John 6. Because for some reason, Robert, when John is writing his gospel, as he tells us this story, he wants you to know this is Passover time. And he doesn't tell us, it was the time of the Feast of the Passover, and this is why I'm telling you this. So we have to start, it's a question we need to ask. John included a detail that no one else did. Now, that happens a lot. Because the Gospel of John is 92% unique versus the other three Gospels. So what's going on that maybe that needs to be included?
Could it be like part of an explanation as to why Jesus was in Jerusalem in John 5?
Okay, maybe it's part of the explanation as to why he was there in John 5. So maybe he's using it just to explain why he had been where he was. Okay, Iris?
I think he's like trying to compare the feasts that the 5,000 are having to the feasts that the people during the Passover were having.
Oh! So say that one more time, a little louder though.
He was trying to compare the feasts that the 5,000 were having to the feasts that the Jews were having for the Passover.
Yeah. He's compare. Could he be? Is he comparing feasts? What do y'all think?
That's a possibility.
Probably.
So, well then, we already went over what the Passover was, right?
Yeah, we talked about what the Passover was last week. How does it compare and contrast to feeding 5,000 people?
Bread.
Okay. Someone walk me through. What was that Passover all about? What was it supposed to be doing? All right. So Ben reminded us it is to celebrate when God delivered the Israelites out of Egypt. Okay.
So then would this be, would he ask God to get something?
Blake, I don't disagree with you that he has not died yet. But we have to wrestle with this concept that Jesus showed up on the planet and presented himself as a ruling Messiah without the contingency of him having to die to be that Messiah.
So then could it be how, what was it you said, that the Passover was to celebrate that they've been delivered from Israel, because we celebrate now that they're going to be delivered from their sins?
It absolutely could be that they're being going to be delivered from their sins. What else would it mean, though? What's the delivered concept with connecting it to a Messiah, if that is indeed the direction we should go with it? Do they know that that Messiah is delivering them from their sins?
Not yet. Mm-hmm. Well, he's not forgiven a couple people.
He's forgiven, okay. But are they? Is the Old Testament Jew and the New Testament Jew of the Gospels, pre-death, burial, resurrection, are they looking for a Messiah who will save them from something? And then what is that something?
Right.
They're looking for a political savior. They're looking for a ruler. Are any of them looking for a savior from their sin, though?
No.
What do you mean not all of them, Blake? You mean some are? So some Old Testament Jews, Old Testament, Old Covenant, I should say. Let's say Old Covenant Jews.
I mean, there's some of the psalmists who are in that.
Okay, so they're looking for something. To celebrate, okay, that there is an anticipation that something is coming.
Yes.
This Messiah. And now you have a Jesus who is feeding 5,000 people, which is taking place before or after Passover?
Could be after the time of, considering that a lot of them probably have already celebrated it.
Well, aren't they on their way back from their early celebration?
They're on the way back from their early celebration.
By the time they're on their way back from their early celebration, would that mean Passover time?
It's definitely, Blake, I would not be shocked if the day that they're doing this feeding of the 5,000 is the actual Passover for the rest of the people. So then what would that be doing in a big picture mindset for all these Jews who are now eating with Jesus? Okay, so... Okay, new celebration. So Tyler, you're taking us kind of the direction of a Lord's Supper idea? Okay. Yeah, there isn't necessarily wine, and I'm not against that, but I don't think we're there just yet.
I have a transition. It's starting to change from
yeah.
the old to the new, but not completely there yet.
I would absolutely agree, an old to a new, a transition period, but who's the transition from and to? Who's the old? Think of Passover. Who is it on an earthly scale that's celebrated out of the Passover?
Moses.
He's the deliverer. Who's the new deliverer?
Jesus
is going to be.
So could it also be they've celebrated all these Passovers, and this is the first Passover they see an actual miracle, and they say now this is the time we're going to be free and free ourselves from Romans?
It could very well be that that's the case, that some of them start thinking that direction. Think about, if this is after the fact, where are these people headed tomorrow and the day after? Where are they going? They're going home, back into the regions of Galilee. Guess what they're taking with them?
That story,
that memory. More importantly, the teaching that's going to come shortly thereafter.
The Sermon on the Mount.
I would say it's Sermon on the Mount. No. All right. So, what are the other details? So that Passover, that should be something, when you see a detail that only shows up in one gospel account, especially if it's something that has ties to how much Old Testament understanding. I mean, it's not like he just said, one guy said, oh, they were, if on the mountain, for example. All right, I think there's less of a big deal to be made out of the mountain reference in John than there is out of the fact that John says this is Passover time. Because Passover is a complete mindset shift for a Jew. Being near a mountain doesn't really change your mindset, other than like, oh, maybe we should tighten up our sandal straps, boys. But Passover, that's a completely different mindset. All right, what are the other details? Let's go this direction so we can start looking, and I'll help guide you guys. How does the conversation get started towards the miracle or the need for food? So if you remember in John 6, lifting up his eyes and seeing a large crowd was coming to him, Jesus speaks to Philip, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? He said this to test him. All right. So in John's version, who speaks first? Who's it to? What's the question? Okay, so Jesus is the first person to speak. Who does he speak to?
Philip.
And what's he speak to Philip about? All right, so Jesus comes to Philip to test him and says, hey, Philip, where are we going to feed all these people? All right, now let's compare. Let's go to Matthew. That's the first account we have. Matthew 14. All right, Blake, did you find who speaks first and what is it that's happening?
Yes.
All right, what verse are you in? Tell us where you are.
14 and 15.
All right, in Matthew 14, 15.
Now, when it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, this is a desolate place, and the day is now over. Send the crowds away to go into the villages and buy food for themselves.
All right. Now, in Matthew's account, the disciples come to Jesus.
But it doesn't specify.
And there's no specificity of which disciple that it is. Okay, interesting. Now if we turn over to Mark. Oh, sorry, yeah. I was just doing Mark because it was the next in biblical order. So in Matthew, while you guys are going to Luke, the disciples come and say, this is a desolate place. Send the crowds away to go buy food for themselves. Okay? Now we're in Mark chapter 6. Someone find it. Tell me what statements are made. Who says it?
Jesus at the first one says, come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while.
Well, I'm referring to when we get to the conversation about the people are hungry.
Disciples came to him and said, this is a desolate place, the hour is late, send them away to go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat.
Alright, so that's almost identical to Matthew, isn't it? Alright, so Mark and Matthew pretty well agree. Then we jump over to Luke 9. Luke 9. Let's see what happens when Jesus feeds the 5,000 in Luke's account. Take a moment, start flipping through those verses. Look for where it talks about them being hungry and needing food. Who does the conversing? All right. Okay, same as Mark and Matthew, so pretty concise agreement. You're starting to see why they call them synoptic? Yeah, there's almost exclusive agreement. I'm sorry?
I just have a side.
Right, well, that's why Matthew, Mark, and Luke are called the synoptic gospels within the larger grouping of the gospels. They're all called gospels because they're the good news of Christ's first advent. But Matthew, Mark, and Luke are very similar accounts. Now, that some include something that others won't. But for the most part, it's like copy. Okay. Well, no, what we're doing right now, Blake, is called harmonizing the Gospels. Like, you are actively harmonizing the Gospels. You're taking all the Gospel accounts, Robert, and you're trying to squeeze them together and say, how do these Gospels all fit together? So you are creating your own harmony of the Gospels right now. Congratulations. I did not do that when I was in high school. All right. So that's the opening of the conversation. Now let's go into what's the initial response. John, where our study comes from, he says that 200 denarii, Philip's response is 200 denarii would not be enough bread to fill these people. Now, does Philip have 200 denarii? What's a denarii? I can't use words like that. We have to define words, don't we?
A day's wage.
All right, a day's wage. 200 days of work to buy bread. He did not say 200 days worth of bread, because the amount of bread that Zach would eat over the next 200 days is not equal to the amount of money or work that Zach would do over the next 200 days and then turn that into purchasing bread. You understand the difference? So, yeah. So he says 200 days of working would not be enough to feed all these people. Now think about that for just a second. Like, that's a lot.
That's a lot of bread. Almost a year.
Yeah, it is almost a year. But, I mean, Robert, just think about how much bread you could literally buy for working for 200 days. Like, not about how many pieces of bread you could buy for working for half a day or an hour. I mean, that's how we think, like, oh, if I make $10 an hour, then I could go buy one meal at Chick-fil-A. So one entire day, 8-hour shift, I could buy 8 meals. Well, obviously, if you made your own bread, it's a whole lot cheaper. Okay? So that response out of John is 200 days worth of working would not be enough to buy bread. All right? What else? What do the other guys say? What about Matthew?
They need not go away. You give them something to eat.
All right. He says, Matthew says, the disciples' response is, or Jesus' response is, they don't need to go away. You feed them. All right. What about Mark? What does Mark say?
Jesus says, you give them something to eat.
All right. You give them something to eat. Huh. There we go. Let's go to Luke. I wonder what Luke's going to say. You think so? Yep. Verse 13. You give them something to eat. All right, so then where does the conversation go? Someone look it up. What's the next thing that happens in these conversations?
We only have five loaves of bread and two fish.
Now, here's the question we have. Well, Ben, which gospel were you looking at?
Matthew and Mark.
All right, so Matthew, Mark, and Luke all say, we've got five loaves and two fish. Here's the question we have to ask, though. Who had the food?
A little boy.
Wait a second. Matthew, Mark, and Luke have not told us anything about this young boy. Have they? Okay, so now we got to go. Who do we go to now? Now we got to go to John. All right. In John 6, verse 7, Philip's response of 200 days of working wouldn't provide enough bread for these people. All right, someone who's going to start reading in verse 8 for us.
I can.
All right, nice and loud, Ben.
One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has five barley loaves and two fish. But what are they for so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down. Now there is so much grass in the place." So the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated.
All right, that'll get us for now. All right, so now we're introduced to another disciple. Ben, what disciple's name did you read?
Andrew,
Simon Peter's brother. Did anyone else mention this disciple?
No, he said Philip.
Yeah, John mentions Philip. But has Matthew said Philip? No. Has Luke said Philip or Andrew? Did Mark say Andrew or Philip? Has anyone else communicated to us of which disciples are involved in these things? They're all non-specific except for John.
Why is John so specific?
Why is John so specific? That's a great question, Blake. Why do Philip and Andrew need included? Why did they get,
maybe just to record extra details that the other Gospels do not, to give more clarity.
I like it, Tyler.
Like Luke 10.
Tyler, say that again a little louder.
So maybe John was just adding details that he knew the other Gospels didn't have, just to add some more clarity.
Okay.
Like Luke has Bethsaida, and then the rest of them say desolate place, mountain, and desolate place.
Okay.
So if you read them all in concordance, then you'll know it's a desolate place in the mountainous area outside Bethsaida.
And we'll also know which disciples were involved in this. Mm-hmm. See, sometimes I think we, at least I do, mostly because Scripture communicates it to us. Don't we get caught up that, like, there are three main disciples? Like, I know Jesus had 12, but really there are only three. Like, this really, like, Jesus could have done it all with just three, right?
No.
Peter, James, and John. I mean, that's who we all we hear about.
And Timothy.
Timothy was not a disciple of Jesus.
Well,
no.
There you go.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, you kind of need Judas in there. Judas is
necessary.
Little necessary to the plot.
Kind of
necessary
for the cross.
Yeah, okay, so four, but we really don't hear a whole lot about Judas prior to. But for some reason, Malachi, Andrew, and Philip get mentioned here. Now, we'll see Philip a little later, but for now, we don't really have any details. But then they tell us, where did they get the food from? The little boy. All right, so how did the little boy get his lunch, and how did the lunch get to the disciples?
Did his mom?
I don't know.
Probably
you tell me, Robert.
Probably know it was the point of the stories. The
right.
Like the cartoons.
Okay.
And Power Hour. Mr. Plain's mom gave him some money.
Yeah, so we just presume that this little boy's mother had packed him lunch.
Yeah.
All right, now think about this for just a second. John doesn't even record the details of how the boy's food gets to the disciples, does he? Go back to John. John's gospel says, one of the disciples, verse 8, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there's a boy here who has 5 loaves and 2 fish. But what are they among so many? Oh, you were thinking of Thomas? So how does the boy's lunch end up in the disciples' hands? I mean, think about this for just a second. How do you think it got there? Let's think through this. Use your sanctified imagination. How does the boy's lunch get to the disciples?
I don't think they took it.
They probably were asking around.
Okay, so Ben says maybe they were asking around, like, hey, do you have any food? Do you have any food? Do you have any food? Now, do you think that's the case, or do you think there's something biblically that might push back against that concept?
The boy volunteered.
Okay. Sarah says maybe the boy volunteered. But do we have biblical evidence that says the boy volunteered his lunch?
No.
Okay, so is there something biblical that might push back against the whole walking around asking which people have food?
Well, it could have been like not, I didn't necessarily mean like that, like, oh, you got food we can use, you got food we can use, like more of just like,
you gonna
are
eat
you guys
that?
Hungry? Do you want? Oh, no, like does, like, did you guys bring food or not?
Okay.
How's that gonna work?
Who here has food and who doesn't?
Like, yeah, you know who's gonna.
So they can take an accurate count of how many they have to feed? Okay. That's absolutely a valid thought. Okay, what was Philip's response, though, when Jesus asked him that question?
Which question is he?
The question out of John 6. Yeah, if you ask Philip, Philip's gonna say, Ben, I could work for 200 days and still not get enough money to buy all these people bread. So maybe the solution isn't that he's walking around asking, hey, do you have food? Do you have food? Do you have food? Maybe that's not what it is. What do you think? And this is why when you're growing up in children's Sunday school or seeing Bible stories portrayed, this is why they do it this way. What is the likely outcome as to how the disciples got the food?
He volunteers it.
That he volunteers it. And realistically, who do you think he's giving it to? He's probably giving it to Jesus. I don't think this little boy is, or young boy, we're not told how old he is. Usually we're given something between like a 10 and 12 year old, you know. I don't think this little boy is like, you know, Philip is by far my favorite disciple. I have all of his trading cards. I want him to have my lunch. I don't think he's been like, you know, Andrew, the dude is so nice. I'm going to share with him. I don't think that's at all what he's doing. I think he's giving his food to Jesus. I think he's aware of the situation. He's been out here all day teaching and doing all these healing miracles. I want him to have my food instead. Those are details John includes that no one else does. Why? Why does John tell you about the little boy that gives Jesus his lunch? What about the narrative changes? What do you walk away from knowing or thinking about when you read John's account of this versus one of the others?
The boy gave up his lunch.
Okay, that the boy's willing to give up his lunch. So what happens if you eliminate the boy?
There's no lunch.
Okay, so is there application then? Is there something that I can apply to my life after reading this much of the story?
Give what you have to Jesus, even if it doesn't seem like a lot.
Okay. Give what you have to Jesus, even if it doesn't seem like a lot.
Mustard seed faith.
Yeah, okay, that mustard seed faith idea. Anything else? Let's take the converse or the opposite of what you just said. What's the opposite of what Tyler said? Tyler said, give to Jesus what you have, even if it's not a lot.
What did you say, like, that actually that's not enough, having that mentality, that what I have is not enough to give? So
okay. What happens if the boy doesn't give Jesus his lunch? There's going to have to be another way that Jesus will provide. Maybe they will just dismiss the crowd. See, Tyler, there's two perspectives on what you said. One side is, even if I feel like I don't have that much, I need to give it to Jesus. The other side of it is, if I don't give what I have to Jesus, someone else may miss out. If this boy doesn't give his lunch to Jesus, this miracle is not happening in this way. Can Jesus cause bread to come out of nowhere? Yeah, obviously, he's been tempted to do so, of turning rocks into bread. Clearly, it's a capability that he has. So he could literally say, everyone, sit down on a rock. Now, reach under your seat and pull out a loaf of bread. He could do that, but he doesn't. So then, when all is said and done, and the people sit down, some of them reference how they're to sit in certain size groups versus not. We see that when it's all said and done, how much food is left over?
12 baskets.
12 baskets. Now, Robert, any other numbers of 12 that maybe you would think would be significant in the Gospels?
The disciples.
Yeah, the disciples.
12 tribes of Israel.
12 tribes of Israel. Is it not interesting, hopefully it is to you, that we start out with, no one has anything to eat. And this little boy offers what he has to Jesus. And he takes it and turns it into more than you could pay for after working for 200 days. Feeds all those people, sends them home satisfied. And oh, by the way, there's still enough left to take over Jesus' people that continue on with him. So let's ask ourselves the two questions that kind of came out of what Tyler said a few minutes ago. Is, do you feel like you have a lot to offer Jesus? And are you giving it to him? And if you're not giving it to him, who is missing out, or what is the church as a whole missing out on because you're not letting Jesus have it? Now in our context, this is critical because, and this is why I think that Passover comment shows up, is the very next discourse, we're going to see the walking on water, and then we're going to see this bread of life discourse in John 6. Jesus, at the time of Passover, where they're celebrating the exodus out of Egypt, God's victory over Egypt, their celebration of all of their time through the exodus and the wandering, then Jesus says, you saw their bread, you can commemorate and remember their bread, look at the bread I give you, and then he's going to drop the mic on him and say, that's actually me that you're eating. Mm-hmm. Which is going to be kind of weird, and they're going to struggle with it, but that's how John 6 plays out. So, we'll stop there for today, and when we come back next Sunday morning, we're not back next Sunday morning. No, there's a 10 o'clock service next week, just main service. And then in 2 weeks, we're back in here for Sunday school.